Hello and welcome to the ACX Masterclass question and answer call. I am Dan O'Day. That gentleman over there is David H. Lawrence the 17th. David?
David H. Lawrence the 17th. That's me. And before anybody asks, yes, that's my name.
And as the name of this teleseminar suggests, the purpose is to take any question you have about audiobooks from the narrator's point of view, in particular as it relates to ACX, and even more particular about the class. Not every question has to be about the class, but the purpose of this call is to help you decide whether or not you want to join the class. So that's our sneaky motive. David, I'm sorry, it just slipped out. You know. That's our sneaky motive. But if people have, it's possible, every now and then someone in a well-meaning way will ask a question that is really off topic. So if someone starts to ask, how do I get a good audiobook agent? I'm not sure that would. David, would you feel that's off topic?
Yeah, because they don't exist. But yeah, it's
or if they said voiceover agent, and well,
yeah,
but we're talking ACX.
Yeah,
we're talking ACX where you don't use an agent. So,
right.
When that happens, it always makes me feel a little uncomfortable. I always be the bad guy, and when that happens, I will gently interrupt and say, "Oh, I'm sorry, that's not the topic." Today. If that happens and you're on the receiving end, please understand I'm not trying to offend you. We all want to get out of here by Sunday. That's all.
So this is the part where you're playing the unrewarding role of bouncer.
Exactly.
In this
you can cross that off the list.
I gotcha. Okay.
So with that said, so the ACX Masterclass, you know, if you don't know what it is, go to the website, please, acxmasterclass.com. Mm. And we have opened registration for our home study version. And if anyone has questions about that, we can, you know, answer that. Otherwise, it's explained on our homepage. Our goal is not to make this a commercial for the class. This is not an infomercial. We genuinely want to give you information that you can use. And if you, David, I'm sorry, I'm not used to doing teleseminars this early. You know, it's only noon here. You know, that's the middle of the night for me.
We did it. Okay.
No, but we do our classes at 6 p.m. Pacific.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So
you have plenty of time to sleep in.
Exactly. So I did already tell people how to tweet. I think maybe that was in the pregame show. So
yep.
I'll repeat it here.
No, I think you said it here, but go ahead.
Okay, if you have a question that you just thought of and you're too shy to ask for some reason, you can tweet it. Oh, yeah, because, I think it was the pregame show. You can tweet it to us, Q&A space at ACX Masterclass. That's how you tweet it to us, and that's how we'll get to see it. And at least one person already has done that. So, David, I have taken longer than I usually take.
Gee, what a surprise.
By definition, if it's longer than usual, it would be a surprise. The
yeah,
way we do this
longer
is...
longer and longer and longer.
If you have a question, please hit *6 on your telephone keypad. Please hit *6 on your telephone keypad. And what will happen is I will see on our online panel that you've raised your hand, figuratively speaking, and I will unmute you. And so then it will be David and me and you. We will be the three unmuted people. And please don't try to be polite by waiting until the present question is answered before you raise your hand. You won't be rude. You won't be interrupting. You actually will be helping everyone by keeping the pace going as quickly as possible. If whenever you realize you have a question, hit *6 on your telephone keypad. If you change your mind and don't want to ask it or somebody asks it for you, you can hit star 6 again, and that will take you out of queue. And the final thing is when you hit star 6 on your telephone keypad, please make sure that you have access to the mouthpiece of a telephone. If you're on Bluetooth or a speakerphone or something, please get off it and so that we'll be able to hear you as soon as we unmute. Star 6 on your telephone keypad, and let's go to our first
question. Dan, I have a question.
Okay.
What will the one person who is being unmuted as you unmute them and call on them, what will that one person hear a woman say
Very good question. When you're unmuted, you will know that you've been unmuted when a voice in your head says, line unmuted. And I'm really glad that David brought it up because you're the only person who will hear that. So if you hear that, you don't have to say, is that me? Because not even David or I heard it. And David, I'm glad you thought of that. So, star 6 on your telephone keypad.
This is Porter Fowler in San Luis Obispo.
I have
a question about... Hello. Hi,
yeah.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Howdy.
I have a question about the environment in which a person does the actual recording. What do most people do? I mean, it's hard to do it in sitting in the park. You're recording a book. So, that's my question.
Well, first, before David gives the technical answer, actually, I believe Central Park at about 2 in the morning in New York is very, very quiet.
Yeah.
Oh, there are no screams? I used to live there. I
the
know.
Occasional,
New York
the occasional, yeah, the occasional sound of a knife entering just below the rib cage. that's all you're hearing. And that's actually pretty quiet. So,
yeah.
So, it's a great question. And the answer is it depends on your home, your apartment, wherever you are. We actually go into great detail about where to select the place within your residence to do this work. I have some clients, we have some students who actually can sit at a dining room table and do the work because they have that quiet of a home. Not usually, but some people do. But once you determine where that is, you'll find that the microphone that we're going to recommend that you use does a really great job of rejecting background noise. And we also, the cool thing about being in this class is that you're part of a community that all of whom have very similar questions and many of whom have figured out what to do in their particular case, and you can always borrow concepts from them. Some people, have complete whisper rooms built into their homes because they really take this seriously and they want to, or Studio Bricks, which is another company that does those sort of rooms within a room. And then there are people who, kick it old school and they hang blankets to ameliorate the reverberant noise within the room. So it depends is the answer. And you'll find that many times when people ask questions like this, it depends is the answer only because it varies from house to house, from apartment to apartment, and from volume level to volume level of extraneous noise.
Okay, I understand that, and you've answered my question. Thank you.
Oh, great. Sure. Thank you.
Dan, did you tell people that when I'm done, they're supposed to say, I thank you, you've answered my question, and
yes.
I understand it? Really?
Yes, I told them that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, right. Why else would you hear it? I mean,
exactly, because I hear it so rarely.
David,
at the
risk of trying your patience,
uh-huh.
You mentioned a number of different ways that people create a quiet environment. If you had to guess, what is the most common way that successful audiobook narrators on ACX, what would you guess is the most common setup in terms of, is you said an apartment, a kitchen, a studio, blankets, porta booth, a whisper room. Do you have a guess?
So for the most part, I think that the, you know, and we teach this in that portion of the class where we talk about getting yourself set up properly. I found that the most successful non-whisper room slash studio bricks installation, in other words, if you're not going to have somebody come in and build you a studio within a room, which can cost thousands of dollars, the most common thing that people do is they go into a walk-in closet, and that's where we tell them to go, and leave the clothes in there, because you know that when you walk into a closet, it sounds completely different from you talking in, and you start to talk, it sounds completely different from you talking in any other part of the house. And for the most part, it's because there's so much stuff in there that, absorbs the sound. So it's the perfect situation, because you want not only isolation from outside sound, but you also want the deadening of the reverberant sound within the room itself. And so that's where most people end up.
And what should we, I don't know if we've ever talked about this, so I'm taking a chance. What do you recommend to say?
I was indicted, but I was never convicted. So if you want to continue talking about it, that's fine.
If somebody says to you, I want to make my room 100% soundproof,
mm-hmm.
what would your answer be?
Well, I would say set aside a budget of about $30,000, which is what I did with my place when I was doing radio on XM and Sirius and on stations across the country. I had a syndicated show, and I did it from my second bedroom. But my second bedroom was built out as a professional studio where the walls are within other walls, and there's an air gap, and it's the way studios are built. Aside from that, what I would say, what was the question, Dan?
How to make it 100% soundproof.
Oh, 100%,
and it was a trick question.
Yeah, it's difficult to make it 100%. I mean, you'll
exactly
once you join other communities with audiobooks as their subject, you'll hear big-time narrators. You'll see them complaining that even though they have a whisper room, even though they have, you know, all the stuff that, you know, everybody tells you to get when you're setting up a home recording space, you know, if the local fire department decides they're going to send five trucks screaming by your house, it's
or
not going to make a difference.
Or if a jet flies over your house.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so, and the reason I asked that trick question, that's what I learned from Harlan Hogan, is Harlan says you can't soundproof. All you can do is minimize the outside sound, but you can't literally make it soundproof.
Yeah. So, I'll tell you, it does change your life if you decide to, you know, go whole hog, and, you know, Studio Bricks is the one that I'm thinking of because it's a European product. And, of course, everything that's produced in Europe is better than it is here, apparently. But in this case, that's actually the case. And I was watching a video with an audiobook narrator who said when she put that in, it changed how she does her work because she knows that she doesn't have to wait for a quiet time in the neighborhood or the leaf blower that the gardener next door is running to stop or the tin roof that her neighbor decided to put on. She can just go and work, because it really is that quiet. So there are varying levels, but to get started and to work and to be successful, you just simply have to make it quiet enough. And that's not so hard to do.
And I don't record audiobooks, but I do a lot of audio recording for my projects, a lot of video, things like that. And sometimes there would be noise outside. So, David, this is my method for cutting down on the noise. I don't think I've shared this with you. My method is this. Hey, you kids, get off my lawn.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's the Clint Eastwood method.
Yeah. So, that's star bad. 6 on your telephone keypad. At the moment, there are no hands up, and not to worry, because we have a number of questions that were submitted to us in advance via email, a couple that are on Twitter, and if you want to ask your question on Twitter, write Q&A and then a space and then at ACX Masterclass so we'll see it. So, David, with your permission, I will go to the questions that were sent to us in advance, and if we see anyone raises their hand, we will jump back to them because I always preach to everyone that live is more interesting than recorded or than planned.
Well, live is certainly more interesting than you reading anything. So.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You know, there's a David. People have joined us to try to decide whether they will enjoy spending an entire month with us.
Uh-huh.
And you're being so nasty to me that I
yeah,
think
I'm being nasty to you.
Yeah, they're starting
okay.
to resent you.
Wait until you hear the recordings and see who's nasty to who.
Okay.
Great.
So actually, someone did raise their hand. Let's hope this person mediates here and
yeah.
gets us back to our normal, friendly, sure. jovial selves.
Sure.
Actually, no, gentlemen. I think it's far too entertaining listening to you both. My question, and Dave, I had been in touch with you regarding
Did you
that,
call me Dave?
David? Dave?
Thank you. David. Yes, I appreciate that. This is Mary, isn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah, and so let me ask you a question. Do you prefer Mare? Do you prefer Marilyn? Marigold? Which do you prefer?
Mary.
Great. I'm going to call you Mary then.
And David, my question, and I'm only voicing this because there may be others in the group who are interested, is to do, there's a variety of accents, and clearly mine is quite distinctive, and I was just wondering what is the appetite out there in the audio world for accents such as mine?
So I'm assuming you have an Australian accent?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And what part of Australia are you from?
North Queensland.
Really? FNQ, huh?
Yes, yes.
Yeah? Cairns, Darwin, Port Jeff? Where are you from? Port Douglas?
Close to Cairns, a little bit under Cairns.
Townsville?
Yes, yes.
Really?
You've
I
been
love that
there.
Area. I would like to retire there.
It's a bit warm, especially
yeah,
at this
but
time
boy, it's like I want to get a piece of land right opposite Scout Hat Island and just sit there for the rest of my life. It would be beautiful.
So
have young
Mary, when you ask about accents, I heard you ask two different questions actually. At first, I heard you say you began by saying people who can do a variety of accents, which made me think you were going to be asking about the value of being able to do a variety of accents. But then you asked about an accent like yours, you know, how is that accepted? Are you asking two different questions? Or
no,
just
I'm not. Actually, the first I phrased it badly. I had noticed on the audiobooks that there is a variety of accents, and that's natural because you're drawing from, a broad pool, even within the States. And but that's what you brought up was an interesting point because, being able to perform, if you will, in a variety of accents has value. But that's not really, it's too hard, especially
Dan?
If you're spending all day in a cupboard, if you,
yeah.
as you pointed out earlier.
David?
I'd like to get back to musing about me retiring in Monmouth.
So here's
yeah. if it is two questions there, but the question that I think Mary's asking is, how do you operate in a world in the States where almost everything that's being asked for is a general American accent or some version of an American accent? And the answer is that ACX has you covered because they have many, many categories of accented books, and they actually just opened up in Australia for Australian workers. They haven't quite developed the system as much as it is here in the United States. Same thing in the UK. The value is tremendous when that's what the project is calling for. The mindset that I would have you take is the same mindset that I would have you take with any other portion of the world of voiceover, and that is that you are an exception to the rule, but like having a very thick Boston accent, or like having a very thick Chicago accent, mm-hmm. or having a very thick Southern accent, when it's called for, you're going to win. You get to do the work. So the value is there. how many opportunities you'll have compared to an American general accent are naturally going to be fewer. But, you know, there are plenty of British people who make their money here in the States doing the work. And part of it is not really treating it as a disability, but treating it as an advantage. So
also,
when they get your audition and you've decided you're just going to use your Australian accent, and, oh, and by the way, did you not read my profile? I'm Australian. And they hear their words with that beautiful, gorgeous Australian accent, and they think to themselves, huh, maybe this would work this way. You know, that's what happens with people with accents.
So I understand. So the other thing you're also saying, therefore, is perhaps if there's an audition up there that to try it, even though you think it's an outside chance that they, it's not exactly what they're asking for.
Yep.
But to
not
proceed,
only that, you're getting practice doing the work. You're getting practice interacting with the system. There's a lot of value that you get from just simply doing it, even though they've chosen a different requirement. You don't have to apologize for it. You don't have to say anything in your audition saying, look, I know that you had this as a general American accent, but I'm going to send this in anyway because that's the kind of hairpin I am. You just go ahead and do it.
Yes.
Right?
Okay. Very good. Cool. Thank you. You've answered my question.
Great. You did tell them to say that, didn't you?
And there's another aspect of that, which is that general American accent is the default for rights holders. If they haven't thought about what kind of accent. And so unless they want New England accent or, you know, Louisiana accent, they are going to choose general American. It's because they have to choose something. And while we don't recommend auditioning willy-nilly for every single job without paying attention to what they say about it, in our first class, I believe it was Janie, who has a lovely British accent, who found a book that she really wanted to audition for, and they said middle American accent, and so we suggested that she go for it, and actually that time at least, I don't recall if you said something or not, but my suggestion was that she do say, you know, very, very briefly, I see you ask for a middle American accent, and then she had another sentence to explain why, and not gushing over the book, but talking about whatever it is that she brings to it. So anyone who has a British accent, you get to cut the line. You get first in line for any audiobook that is a nonfiction authoritative. You know, if somebody writes a book about etiquette, you know, you're going to have a better chance than somebody else. And that's because Americans believe there is only one British accent, and we believe that everyone who speaks with a British accent is more intelligent than we. So it definitely can be an advantage. But I would really encourage you not to apply for a book that asks for an American accent and you haven't determined, you know what, I've looked at the material and I looked at the author's body of work and I believe I could do a good job for this rights holder. So *6 on your telephone keypad if you have a question for David H. Lawrence, the 17th, or Dan O'Day. This is the Q&A call for the ACX Masterclass Home Study course, and our website is acxmasterclass.com. So I will go to the written questions until we see some hands go up.
Okay.
Okay. Susan says, I have been able to acquire work with ACX. I have voiced one novel and one nonfiction book. However, I really have a passion for doing children's books, but I don't want to just share royalties any longer. And David, maybe you can explain to everyone what she's talking about. And I have found very few children's book authors on ACX. What can I do to find work in this niche?
So on ACX, you're going to do a lot of research about each author title, project you do, and that extends out to beyond ACX. So you always want to figure out who these authors are, what their communities are like, their communities of both fans and their engagement with those communities. Sometimes more developed authors have events that they'll attend, but most of the stuff that's being done today is being done through social media, so that's where you'll do an awful lot of your research. Children's books are kind of rare on ACX because the distribution process for children's books is a little bit different than the distribution process for adult books. Whereas adult books, there's a straight path through ACX to Audible and iTunes and Amazon. Children's books are usually sold via individual sites if they're digital downloads. Certainly there are children's books that are available from other publishers on Audible, etc. But they're also sold mostly through places like Toys R Us and Discovery Zone and Babies R Us and you know, toy stores. And children's, sometimes children's clothing stores and accessory stores. So there's a little bit of a different path there, and that's why they're not as prevalent on ACX. But they are there, and you can find work both on ACX and off ACX. The good news about ACX is that ACX is this wonderful crucible for learning about how the business works from Audible's perspective. That knowledge is transportable to working with other publishers as well. Now, the class deals specifically with ACX, and so what we do is we teach you how to maximize your chances and your presence on ACX. But once you have that, you can then go to Random House and Tantor and Dion and Blackstone and all of these others with your body of work and say, hey, I'm really interested in children's books. If you have any, please keep me in mind, also for the other books that you do. I would also suggest just that the question being, I really have a passion for doing children's books, but I don't want to just share royalties any longer. Understand that your option is going to be either sharing royalties or getting paid per finished hour. And if the book takes off, you know, I imagine that the experience you've had with the one novel and the one nonfiction book that you have is that they didn't sell very well, and that's why you're not interested in sharing royalties. I will tell you that if you do your research well, you might change your mind about that. And you can also set your price so that it is remunerative in a way that makes you want to do the work. So, you know, there's ways around this idea that, royalty share is not to your liking, both on finding better projects and then also creating a price point for per finished hour that is reasonable.
So royalty share, fairly self-explanatory, that means you don't get paid anything up front. You share the royalties with the author, 50-50. The author makes X amount, you make X amount per sale. Per finished hour is the however long the book times out, and they have a formula for knowing that in advance. You get paid a flat rate per hour, and it can range from, I guess, as low as $50 an hour to $1,000 an hour. What's that, Dave?
If you want to, you can do it for free.
But then you wouldn't. That's not being paid.
Right, I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, I mean, none of our students, I think we would throw them out of the mastermind group if they wanted to charge under $100, which is the absolute bottom.
Yeah, and we give you very clear guidelines as to how to set those prices for a number of reasons, not the least of which is creating a health and retirement plan, especially if you're in the union, but even if you're not in the union. So we go very deep into all of that.
And there was one more thing about, the thing about, there is a very common misperception in the audiobook narrating community that nobody ever makes money on a royalty share. That seems to be the most common belief regarding payment. And so everyone wants to get either a royalty share or what's called a stipend, which is a combination of getting paid per finished hour and a royalty share. But they are mistaken in thinking that no one can make money on that. The thing is, they don't choose their titles wisely.
Yeah, I think they've given up on the research.
Yeah, what they do is intuitive. It makes sense on the surface. So, I mean, the lowest level of narrator on ACX, they will accept anything they're offered, and they will audition for anything they see. They don't care. They're just desperate. I think the more common thing that narrators do is they audition for things that interest them. They like the topic, or they like the niche, or they're offered a job. And unless they absolutely hate the subject matter, if they're offered erotica and they are a very conservative religious person who would never do that, except for asterisks like that, they accept anything. And that's what leads directly to so many people saying you can't make money with royalty share, because before they accept it or before they audition for it, there are specific steps they should go through to predict the odds that it can make money. And we had one of our students, whom we're very proud of, from our first ACX masterclass, Joseph Narducci, had never recorded an audiobook before joining the class, never. And he recorded one audiobook, and I don't remember if he... David, do you remember if he auditioned for it or if the author found him?
I think he auditioned for it.
So he auditioned for it. He got it. And the book sold quite nicely. It started to sell more quite nicely when Joseph became an Audi nominee. So it's like being nominated for an Academy Award, the day after you leave acting school. And if his book had won, and doggone it, I frankly think they're fixed, because I think he should have won. If that book had won, it would be displaying, the audiobook advertising would be displaying Audi winner, 2015 Audi winner, and that probably would have doubled the sales. But so Joseph is quite happy with what he's getting from that, and some of our students who do royalty shares are quite happy. But you can't just assume. You've got to do the research, as David says. So *6 on your telephone keypad if you have a question for David H. Lawrence XVII or Dan O'Day. We are talking about ACX and more specifically trying to help anyone decide whether or not they want to sign up for the home study version of our ACX Masterclass. Registration is open right now at acxmasterclass.com. And if you want to do it and you're just kind of procrastinating and, waiting, the early action bonuses disappear tomorrow. So if you've decided this is right for you, please go ahead and register. So let's see here. Looking at things that were sent to us. Well, okay, this certainly ties into it. Maybe this repeats some of the ground, but Gwen says, how about, or what are the steps to winning the auditions for stipend and other projects that pay? So we just spent a lot of time talking about what they mean. What are the steps for winning those as opposed to royalty share?
I think the steps to winning those are exactly the same as the steps to winning royalty share, and that is being the voice that brings the characters to life. I don't see any difference between winning a job that is per finished hour versus winning a job that's a stipend job or a royalty share job. what you'll find is that there's a lot more people auditioning for it. And so this is the same question that was asked about 2 decades ago when I was at a Billboard convention. And the whole I can do this on my own indie scene was really picked up. Somebody stood up in the middle of the crowd and addressed a group of people who were very successful musicians and said the following: how do I get past people like you to get the work?
What?
And on the surface, you know, that's kind of a provocative question. It's like, hey, get better at what you do and you'll be able to get up here on the dais with us and get the work that we're getting. what he was saying was all of these other independent musicians who were vying for a label contract were in his way. And, you know, that's the noise floor that you are faced with when you go to ACX. All of these other narrators are in your way. That's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is, I'm me. I have my path in life. I have my ability to do this work. And I'm not going to pay one bit of attention to other people. I'm going to do this and do it at the best level that I can. I'm going to, you know, find the books that make sense to me in terms of what I want to do for work and also the author's ability to generate an audience that will buy this book. You know, I've watched over the last year and a half our students jump in the private Facebook group that we have for everybody time and time again and say, hey, I didn't think I would get this, but I got a stipend. Hey, I didn't think I'd get this, but I got a PFH of $225 an hour. And what happens after a while is you realize it's not as rare as you think. And that part of the approach to this is to try to look for projects where all the pieces fall into place. And we show you how to do that in the class. But I don't think there's any magic formula or any change that you need to make in your approach to win auditions for stipend projects or projects that pay per finished hour as opposed to royalty share projects. So I think that's the question is be better. You know, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice.
Well, that makes me think of two things. One is whenever in the mastermind group somebody posts that they just landed, pretty much when people land a new job, they post it. And when it's a stipend or per finished hour, they say that. And it's pretty common. And whenever that happens, David, this is probably small of me, but whenever that happens, I can't help but think of the couple of people who have posted remarks saying, one person said, you have to have been doing audiobooks for years and years before you ever will get a stipend. And possibly if you approach it the way they do, but most, like anything else, most people don't really think about it. And there is one more thing, Susan, that you can do to increase your chances of getting a stipend.
This is Gwen.
Gwen. I'm sorry, Gwen.
Yeah.
And that is something that almost nobody on ACX does, and that is pay attention to your profile. And I think that's the first week we actually teach this. Profiles of 92.5% of narrators on ACX are just incredibly awful. And by that I don't mean, oh, gee, this is not well written or artistic or clever. What I mean is it's written in a way that no rights holder is going to read any of it. And that's because they're writing from their point of view, and you need to create your profile from the point of view of someone who is looking to hire a narrator. And I do think that that has helped some of the students that we have who've landed that kind of book. I think that has helped them also.
Yep.
and somebody, well, I'll wait till we get to that question. I was going to add something else that relates. *6 on your telephone keypad. That is David H. Lawrence, the 17th. I am Dan O'Day. We're from the ACX Masterclass, acxmasterclass.com. Registration is open at the moment. And, oh, it was. Okay. The thing I was looking for, Gwen asked a second question. That's what confused me. I get confused easily. Oh, wait, David, I'm sorry. I said I had two things to mention. And I mentioned them. Okay. So Gwen also asks, what's a good place to mention? This is a good place to mention, okay, in the email she sent us. This is a good place to mention that it's not uncommon for our students to receive stipend and PFH jobs, which we just discussed, plus the new hybrid stipend. So, and somebody else had asked about that too. So there is something that David actually invented, the hybrid stipend. David,
I did not invent this. I just named it this and said this seems like it would be useful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that I think is interesting about this whole space is that you can take advantage of things that you've learned in other areas. I've always felt like, you know, we sometimes take moments in our lives as discrete events, and we don't think to ourselves, huh, wait a minute, back when I was at, you know, name of company goes here, we had a similar situation, and this is how we handled it. Maybe I'll try it that way. It's amazing how things that have happened time and time again in our work life, in our personal life, in our corporate history, in the way that we solve these problems, you know, we kind of tend to think, well, you know, if we don't come up with some new and fascinating solution to it, it can't be solved. And the truth is, that's rarely the case. And so one of the things that I thought about was when I was doing work as a narrator for training films. We had a very similar situation where the company that hired me said, hey, would you want to do a revenue share on this? You know, every time we sell one of these training films, we'll give you, you know, $200, because they were selling these training films for like $3,000. Hey, if we do that, how about if you just do the session for free? And I said, you know, hey, how about if I get paid union scale and I get $200 every time you sell the film? And they actually said yes to that. So, you know, all throughout the course of my history, when as a freelancer, as a performer, you know, producers tend to be cheap. They tend to want to, you know, and it's their fiduciary responsibility to be cheap, to minimize the outlay and to maximize the income for the project. And when you start thinking about things from a producer's standpoint, you can gain insight as to what motivates them and what makes them want to do this kind of work and to hire you. So when I presented that, I said, look, I'll just take scale rather than what you've been paying me, which was over scale, but I'll also happily take that commission every time you sell or royalty share. You can name it anything you want. So I think that, you know, the fact that I, quote, came up with this or invented this, I think is a bit of a misnomer. I just remembered, and I'm certainly others have done similar things, I just remembered that, you know, sometimes the person in charge of getting the project done is willing to be creative along with you as the talent as to how you get paid.
Well,
and
David,
so it happens to work out,
to
work out really well with ACX. What, Dan?
You're saying you didn't invent it, but you systemized it.
Yeah,
You took the inspiration from your past experiences and created something that applies specifically to ACX and how to use it.
Right. And I also found that it was a willing marketplace to do that. If by and large or exclusively rights holders were like, what? I don't pay for things like that. Well, you know, in the old days, back in, you know, 2008, before ACX was around, that's how people paid for things. Rights holders paid per finished hour, and that was it. And it was ACX that introduced the idea of a royalty share as part of the internet, you know, the sharing community and the internet community that does revenue shares left and right. You know, that was a natural sort of point for them to get to. This is how we'll help people make money. But that doesn't mean you can't look back and go, hey, what works best? And so what we do is we try to give you every option there is, and we go very deep into each one of these options so that you know how to approach the rights holder and you know what you're talking about and what your requirements are. You know, I can share with you, as I've shared with the class, that I charge per finished hour of $1,000. So if it's a 10-hour book, I make $1,000 on the finished hours of that book, so it's a $10,000 job for me. And there are lots of people who are struggling to figure out how to even find books that make any money, let alone books that make a good deal of money. And that's my goal. That's my wish for everybody who takes this class, that you find the path that leads you to joyous compensation, not just compensation, but joyous compensation.
And David, that question actually was submitted on Twitter by VoiceOver Karen.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's not whoever I said. You know, this is somewhat ironic. I don't know if you noticed, David, in one of the videos we released, one of our students, to my surprise, one of the students said that the single most valuable thing she found in the class, and this was surprising, and I'm sure she's the only one who said it, she said, was the wonderful study guides that Dan created for us to help us understand, because it was so well organized, everything was laid out, everything thought out, and now here I am, I can't even get the right name for the right question.
Yeah.
So
she was obviously mistaken.
Yeah, I think that was as we say in Hollywood, a one-time phenomenon in the class.
Yeah.
Star 6 on your telephone keypad. David, I want to go back to something dealing with mindset, and that guy years ago who stood up and said, how do I get past guys like you?
Yeah.
Because that, to me, I would call it a mindset question. As you know, and I'll be very brief about this, a friend and I, almost every year, we conduct a two-day workshop for people who want to write TV sitcoms. And my friend is extremely well qualified to be teaching this. And his name is Ken. And I hope he doesn't hear this, because he'll probably be upset knowing that, oh, no, some people are going to hear what I say and it'll ruin the spontaneity of it. But each year, there are 20 people who attend from around the world. And it's a really cool event. And each year, it begins with a teaching lecture from Ken. And he talks about various aspects of writing for television. And then he says, we have 20 students here. The odds are only 3 of you will make it. Now, you have two different ways. People will react to that two different ways. Some people will react, oh, man. 3 out of 20, those are terrible odds. You know, woe is me. Some other people will react, I wonder who the other two will be. And that's the kind of mindset that I encourage for you, assuming that you have the chops, that, you know, you know how to record, that you're a good performer. The odds really don't matter. It all boils down to one, and whether you're going to get that one job that you are vying for. Mary changes the subject completely, although we still are talking about the ACX Masterclass and acxmasterclass.com. She says, my worry about recording always revolves around technology. Does this course address that aspect thoroughly?
Well, I can't think of another course that spends as much time on two things as we do. Number one, making you aware and adept at meeting the requirements for ACX submissions. They have very specific requirements for ACX submissions. And showing you that the amount of technology that you need to purchase, the amount of technology that you need to learn, is far less than most people think. And I'm a geek boy. I've been doing computers since the early 70s, mainframes and minis and personal computers. I've worked for companies like AOL and Google and Yahoo and Excited Home, and and I have my own technology companies. I am a tech fanatic, but I'm not a tech fanatic in the way that some people consider tech people, like the guy on Saturday Night Live, the guy around the copiers, or the guy that would come and fix your computer and yell at you because you did something wrong. What I want is I want you to have the ability to sit down at your desk, swing your microphone into place or place it in front of you, and start to work, and know that along the way you will encounter certain processes and procedures that you need to, execute, but you'll be able to execute them flawlessly. You'll be able to execute them because you have the muscle memory from the class and from practice and from your homework of doing exactly what you need to do and to get your book accepted by ACX and to get your stuff done. And what we've tried to do is make it brain dead simple, so that there's no shades of gray, certainly not 50 shades of gray, but no shades of gray in terms of, well, do I kind of do this? Here's what you do, period. And when we reduce it to a math problem rather than to an artistic problem, the math problem, the logic problem of when do I do this, how do I do it, what are the settings, what do I do, boom, you will find that this is the least of your worries, and it frees up mind share for you to pay attention to your performance. So the answer to the question is, do we address this technology thing thoroughly? I believe we address it more thoroughly than any other class I've taken, any other class I've designed.
David, do you realize how scary to someone who never has recorded audio the idea of recording and editing themselves is?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I see it every day. Both Dan and I have clients outside of ACX Masterclass, and I would venture to say that almost everyone that has come to me new to the business has that fear to some degree or another. And mostly it's just simply a fear of the unknown because they've never done it before. They think that, computers are difficult and equipment is finicky and software can bomb on you and quit and, it's horrifying. Well, those are all the worst case scenarios. It can also be lovely. And that's what we show you how to create.
Last year, I took some flack from some audiobook people. How unusual, David. When I was trying to drive this point home, that recording, this was purely talking about recording your voice via Audacity, which is the free software we recommend. Recording your voice is actually easier than figuring out how to use your universal TV remote.
Yep.
And some people were outraged. So I actually took a poll on Facebook. It was limited to people who already are quite accomplished at audio recording and editing. They're quite comfortable with it, I should say. And I said, okay, those of you who are quite comfortable with it, how many of you can work the remote, and how many of you still haven't figured it out? And something like 78% said, no, I still haven't figured it out. I mean, it, as David said, it's fear of the unknown, which attacks us all. And one thing that happens if you really get scared about something like this, and for that matter, David, this applies to people who are very experienced at recording audio. We come along and say that David H. Lawrence the 17th has invented, and I believe that in this case that does apply, has invented a way of editing for audiobooks on Audacity that dramatically reduces the time that you spend editing. And we know, I know for a fact it's true, because I have seen it. We've never had a student say they couldn't do it. Well, we get again and again and again, when we get to the week where David teaches it, we'll see in the mastermind group lots of postings that start with, oh, my God, I can't believe it. And what happens, though, especially if you already know how to edit audio, maybe for voiceovers or for radio, you try to picture in your mind's eye a faster way of editing, a more efficient way of editing, and you can't, because you don't know what you don't know. You can't imagine what you don't know exists, and you can get caught in this endless loop of, well, I can't picture it, so it must not be true. But it's ridiculously easy. And for everyone listening, has there ever been a time in your life when you have asked a magician, or even just a friend who was doing a magic trick, you have asked someone to show you how this wonderful magic trick was done? Do you recall that? It might have been when you were a kid, or maybe when you're adult. Wonderful magic trick, and the person told you or showed you how it was done. And remember your response. Your response was tremendous disappointment. And you said, that's it? It's the same thing with David's editing technique, except it's not disappointment. It's tremendous excitement. But it's an excited, that's it? I mean, that's all I got? That's all? It's kind of unbelievable. So Star 6,
it's interesting, because just this past week, talk about people who have spent their whole lives becoming audiobook narrators and good ones, and having spent lots and lots of money and spent lots and lots of time learning very, very difficult pieces of software and traditional methods of recording. Once again, this past week, somebody who is very well established in the business, I was posting, there was a question on one of these things, was what software do you use? And everybody was saying Pro Tools and Logic and Reaper and Reason and Twisted Wave and all this. And I said, you know, not to be unpopular, Audacity. It works for me and it works really well. And this torrent of vitriol about how Audacity doesn't include the things that you need to get audiobooks done, it's the worst possible choice. You know, this is from people who have this sunk cost of having learned all these other pieces of software, which, by the way, I know very well. I'm certified by Avid as a Pro Tools editor, but would I choose to use Pro Tools like they do? Absolutely not. I'm just going to happily let them yell and say, one of them said, oh, we've heard about your stair-step method, and it doesn't work as well as what we do.
It's like, they can tell by hearing about it?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. And it's like, and it's one of those things where you go, okay, all right, fine. Sorry I stepped into the middle. Thank you for reminding me where I was on the Internet, in the middle of a bunch of people who have a vested interest and this amazing well of experience, and that's kind of a double-edged sword. They certainly know what they're talking about when it comes to their stuff, but they don't want to even think about the fact that there may be another process that they're not completely familiar with that is better. You know, I imagine that when people started driving automatic cars, automatic gears, you know, cars with automatic transmissions. That is like, this is crazy. This can't be better. You need a stick shift, you know. And I can think of millions of other examples where we've done things one way for a long time, and all of a sudden a new thing comes along, and it's easier, and it's faster, and it's better. And that's kind of how I feel about this. Whatever they have to say, I understand the emotional reasons behind them getting upset. What I would say to you is just enjoy the fact that you don't have any of those sunk costs. You don't have any of that deep experience that you've invested time and money in. And you're starting from scratch, so you can actually start with something that works better.
Ironically, all of those people who say they are very good at editing with, let's say, Pro Tools, at some point, they weren't. At some point, they didn't understand it at all. And if they're human, they probably were really intimidated the first time somebody tried to show them. And it's really the same experience. By the way, David, Robert Taylor, who is on this call, I believe is on this call, just registered for the class. Robert Taylor from Rancho Mirage.
Thank you, Robert. Looking forward to working with you.
So that's Rancho Mirage, California. Okay, this is another question that it's a leading question that we did not set up, so you don't know I'm going to ask you this.
Okay.
David, you know, all this talk about cheap Audacity versus Pro Tools or, you know, Avid or whatever. Can one piece of software do a better job than another piece of software in recording a voice onto a computer hard drive?
No.
So are you telling me that you can get you? Are you telling me that Pro Tools does not do a better job of recording your voice than Audacity?
That's exactly what I'm telling you.
Okay. It's all ones and zeros. Now, it's what you do with it afterward where there are differences, and blessedly, for audiobooks, what you do with it, other than making sure that it is clean and that it meets ACX standards, is you do nothing. You know, you're not mixing in music and sound effects and all kinds of
yeah,
things.
Yeah, I mean,
that.
You know, the everything gets adapted. You know, before audiobooks were being recorded at home by people, they were being recorded in studios. They continue to be recorded in studios. You know, I do work both on ACX. I do work directly for Audible. I do work for publishers like Random House. I have a new book that's out this week on the Robert Durst case called A Deadly Secret. And it was recorded in a studio with Pro Tools. Pro Tools was not designed to record audiobooks any more than it was designed to sweeten movies or record commercials or record hit songs. It is simply a tool. I would choose that tool if I was sweetening a movie. I would choose Pro Tools because I think it's the best at it. But for audiobooks, what you want is agility. You want speed. You want accuracy, and you want what all audiobook software has, or all audio software has, and that is the ability to record the voice that's being spoken into the microphone connected to the computer. And all software does that portion of things, the recording of your voice, equally well. Any free software you get that records, any paid software that you get that records, it all records the voice equally well. And as Dan said, there are options in many pieces of software to color the sound, to add EQ and compression and expansion and effects and so on. Audacity has those too, but we don't use those. We never use those. So what makes Audacity so spectacular for me is, A, it's free. B, it has a vibrant community of developers around it, so it's not a piece of orphan software. And C, it takes very little space on your hard drive and is ready to work with instantly. for those of you that use Pro Tools, you know that once you've used Pro Tools for a while and you're working on a project for a while, it takes a while for Pro Tools to boot once you double-click the icon. It takes a while for you to be able to work. With Audacity, when you open it up, from the moment you, from if you were to move your mouse from the double click of the icon of Audacity over to where the record button will end up being when the window opens, you're ready to record. So it takes less time for Audacity to make itself available to you than it is for you to move your mouse across the screen and click the record button. And that comes up time and time again, and it's why I chose Audacity over the other. I mean, I eat my own dog food, right? I'm not saying to you, hey, use this microphone, use this software, use this process, and I'm doing something completely different. I'm doing exactly what I teach. Why would I want to not share with my students the things that work for me? So, yes, the answer to your question is no piece of software records audio better than any other piece of software.
In some ways, as both of us come from a radio background, it's cool to be able to edit. And it's we don't usually admit this, say this out loud, but we enjoy it when people are really impressed. Like, David, if you remember way back in your early radio days when you learned how to chop the S off a word, how
yeah.
cool you thought that was.
Oh, how cool I thought it was. You should have seen my production director going, how'd you do that?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I really believe that part of why I'm good at what I do today is, for those of you that have read The Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell, you know that the consensus is that 10,000 hours of doing something will make you pretty much a world-class expert at that something. And I can tell you that I am a very, very fast and very, very accurate, to this day, reel-to-reel tape editor with tape and razor blades and you know, a big Sony or an MCI tape deck. I know how to do that really well, and editing in software is like, it's actually criminal how easy it is compared to what razor blades and you know, tape required us to do.
But people, I think most production people were absolutely terrified. They were great. The ones who were great at editing with on tape with a razor blade were terrified about learning how to how to edit digitally. And it's going
yeah.
back to that same reason. They couldn't picture it. They couldn't imagine what it would be like. And so they would put it off and put it off. And as David says, I love the old-fashioned analog editing. You know, I love having that razor blade and that little skinny piece of tape, you know, and draping the tape around your shoulders, heads out, just in case you have to splice it back in. When I finally learned a little bit about editing digitally, it was a whole new world, starting with the fear is removed because you always can, you know, undo something. But I guess I'm belaboring this just because we get so many questions about it, and also because so many outsiders have scoffed at this. I remember somebody else posted on my blog, because, you know, in the class we tell you you can use any equipment you want. We recommend Audacity, which is free. And we recommend this particular microphone, which is about $150. And one person who has recorded a lot of audiobooks, apparently, or at least some, posted a response saying, do you really think a publisher will entrust their book with someone who uses a $150 microphone?
And, well, now we have evidence. So.
Well, But to me, here's why that question misses the point completely. David, how many times has someone considered hiring you as an audiobook narrator? And before they hired you, they said, well, okay, first tell me about the equipment you'll be using.
Very, very rare that somebody says that.
I mean,
some people do, but very rare.
Yeah, they don't care. And
yeah, they've heard my body of work, and they kind of assume that I've got the right equipment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so if you look at people's profiles on ACX, you'll see people going on and on listing all the equipment that they have in their studio, and maybe 1 out of 1,000 rights holders cares. So this is interesting. This is the first time we have done a Q&A call in which people were so shy about speaking. You know, a lot of people emailed questions, and some people tweeted. So this might be the last call, *6 on your telephone keypad. We have 2 or 3 questions left that were emailed to us. And two of them are from Danielle.
Okay.
Danielle says, I wrote a mystery novel that will be the first in the series. The story is told in the first person. I'd like to be the narrator of the audiobooks. How do I know if my voice is right for it?
Well, the good news is, you know, you're in a position to make that decision wholesale. You don't have to worry about it. You know, if you feel like your voice is the right voice for it because you're the rights holder, you get to make that choice. And the author as narrator, we have a number of students who are also book authors, and they're either voicing their own stuff or they want to start to voice other people's stuff. You can make that choice. In general, what I would suggest you do is if there's any doubt that your voice is the right voice for one of your works, go put it up for, as a project on ACX from the rights holder's perspective. Putting up a project is very easy. And listen to some auditions and see if you think they're better than you. If in the end you just want to do the voice and you don't really care what other people sound like, then just do it. I mean, that's your right and your prerogative. And, you know, there's a whole subsection of our audiobook narrator community that are called authors as narrators or authors as voice. And it happens all the time. I don't know which Danielle this is. I have a couple of people that I have in mind that are either Dan's clients or my clients, and I think I know what your voice sounds like if it's the one I'm thinking of, but I don't know. I think you'd be fine doing it, and especially because the mystery novel that you wrote, you understand very, very clearly. I would imagine that the same artistic tenets that came into play when you wrote the book from your own experience and from the experience that you researched will lend itself really well to you narrating the book as well. And you might find out as you're narrating it, oh, did I write that? Huh. That's pretty good. So that's what I would say.
And one of the students from our class earlier this year, Tanya Mills, is an author, and she had never recorded anything. And she joined the class, just as you said, David, to learn how to record her own stuff. And she explained it by saying, nobody knows my characters as well as I do. And so she feels very protective of it.
Yep.
But now she also is being booked as an audiobook narrator. And I don't know if this is ironic or just something that hadn't occurred to me. It appears most of the bookings she's getting now are from other authors. When they find out that she voiced her own audiobook, their response is not, oh my God, how did you learn to do that? How can I learn to do it? Their response is, would you consider doing mine?
Yeah,
because to them it's mysterious.
Yeah, I actually just did the bonus session. When I did the bonus session with her, it was a conversation about, yes, her equipment, and we did it over Skype so I could see the interior of her space. And this is what you can use your if you sign up before tomorrow night, you can use your bonus for with me or with Dan. We can look at your space in Skype, and we can look at your equipment and so on and how you've got it placed. And one minor adjustment was so powerful for her in terms of her equipment, and then one other minor adjustment was so powerful for her in terms of her performance that she just walked away so happy. I got two thank you notes afterwards. And, you know, I can tell you without fear of retribution that Dan and I take your career very, very seriously. We take your journey very, very seriously. I often will say, my job is to defend the success of your career, to defend it from others and what they might say, to defend it by giving you the best possible opportunities, and also to defend it by making sure that the mistakes that other people make are mistakes that you don't make. So best practices and avoiding worst practices is really what you know, I love to do, and I know Dan loves to do as well. When we discover something that works really well for the students and for our clients, it's like, how quickly can we share this? And working as an author who is narrating her own work is probably one of the most joyous things Tanya said she's done. So, yeah.
David, although we have two more questions that were sent in advance, someone has raised their hand by hitting *6 on the telephone keypad. So let's take their question. I'm Dan O'Day. That gentleman is David H. Lawrence XVII. And all of this conversation is about recording audiobooks, specifically via the ACX platform. And it just so happens that David and I teach a class called the ACX Masterclass. And registration is open right now. It's acxmasterclass.com.
Oh, Dan and David, it's Mary yet again. My question actually is a direct secateur to your last comment. Does it give us, we prospective narrators, more credibility to a prospective employer / rights holder if they know that the students, we've been committed sufficiently to be students of the ACX Masterclass?
Well, I'd like to think so. It's kind of like, you know, nobody's ever asked me for my college degree as a performer. Where'd you go to school? What'd you major in? You know, the truth of the matter is I dropped out of college in my sophomore year. But nobody's ever asked. And I doubt anyone will ask, if you've taken this class, I certainly don't mind if you mention it in your profile, but I, you know, like anything else in the creative space, it's the work that gets you the work. It's your abilities, it's your skills, and so to that end, sure, taking this class will give you skills and abilities that will reflect positively when you audition for things. But I don't think, you know, it's not like somebody's going to be working at a Wall Street firm and go, yeah, oh, you went to Harvard Business School? Great, come on, you're on board. You know, sometimes people like that don't get the job. But I can tell you that you will have a much better chance at success if you understand thoroughly every part of the performance, the business, the technology, the what to do when. You know, I want you to have as much ammunition in your belt and as many really good, effective weapons in your belt to get this job done as you can. So, and I'm saying this, you know, because I believe it to be true. I don't think there's a better training process for working on ACX and with other publishers than this.
Yep. Mary, it's Mary, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. To your original question of will having taken the ACX Masterclass, not in terms of improving your skills, but will it increase the likelihood of you being hired when the rights holder or the publisher or the producer sees that you took our class? Is that going to, are they going to go, oh, she took the ACX Masterclass. Must be pretty good. My answer to that is no. I just don't believe that that'll happen. Because I don't. It's like people who tell you who they studied acting with. There are a lot of terrible people who studied acting with good people. That doesn't mean they're a good actor. So I don't think that it's not going to hurt you, but it's not going to help you. And I disagree with David. I don't think it should be in your profile. And I won't take up the time now to go into it. That is something we teach. Again, the first week I do a fairly extensive look at profiles. I recommend not putting your training in your profile. And, you know, if David thinks it belongs there, then we just have a disagreement.
Well, I think I was saying that in the context of what her actual question was do rights holders look for us to have been having taken this class? And I think
let's unmute her.
Yeah.
Mary, do you remember how you phrased it?
Yeah, well, my question, it was more to do with, you know, I understand everyone has different gifts and there's going to be different levels of abilities, and it was more the credibility and the commitment, because if you were a rights holder, I would imagine that you want to know your narrator, who you're about to make an investment in, you know, is going to deliver, just deliver on time, and that to me is, and it could be, if it's a bigger book, if you will, may be a bigger issue. I'm not sure. I'm a learner.
That's how I heard your question. And my answer from my point of view is no. They are not going to look at it and say, oh, this person must be more committed. That's the price of admission to play the game. They assume that you have done whatever mysterious things narrators do to become good enough to narrate audiobooks. And I don't believe that it's going to impress anyone. It's not going to hurt you, but I don't believe that anyone will be impressed. Mary,
just like they wouldn't be impressed if you went anywhere else.
Oh, no, you know, oh, of course. It's not they're going to scoff at us. But I'm just, you know, sure. And I agree with David. As biased as we are, I mean, this is, I'm being influenced now by what our mastermind group keeps saying in the group about how wonderful the class is and even how wonderful we are, me more than David, but, you know. I lost my track of thought.
The mastermind group.
Oh, I know. So because of that, I absolutely believe this is far and away the best way for a would-be audiobook narrator or a current audiobook narrator to learn how to succeed at ACX. Far and away. And if anyone doesn't realize I'm biased, let me point out that the class was created by David and me. But that still is my opinion. But Mary, it's like, do you think Dustin Hoffman is a good actor?
Yes.
Okay. And where did he study drama?
I understand.
You know?
Point taken.
That's the point. But excellent question. And last chance, star 6 on your telephone keypad. We have one question left that was sent to us in advance, and so if no one else raises their hand, soon we will be done. The last question and then the question following the last question.
Okay.
Let's do the question following the last question first because the answer is quick.
Okay.
Karen Eileen, with a hyphen, says,
mm-hmm.
What's the price difference between the summer home course and the live course? So the live course is the course that we taught in February and March of this year. What's the price difference?
I'll let you handle that.
It's exactly zero. It is, you know, it's not a it's not a discounted course. And I'm not offended at your question. It's a very logical question. But we did not say, okay, let's just, can we just throw some stuff at people and we'll charge them less money and they'll think it's a bargain and we'll make, you're going to have the same experience that the people in the live class had. But the direct answer to your question is there is no price difference between the summer home course and the live course. Okay, Danielle says, several of the people in the testimonials, now I don't know if she means the written testimonials on our website, acxmasterclass.com. That would be /kudos, K-U-D-O-S, or she means in the videos that she saw. Several of the people in the testimonials indicated they were already actors or voiceover artists. How have those with no experience or training done with a course?
Well, aside from our Audi nominee.
Joseph Narducci had, I know he'd never done voice work, and I don't think he'd ever done acting, right?
Actually, he had done a little bit of voice work. He works at a television production firm, and they had him do some scratch tracks.
Oh, okay.
But that was it. And for those of you that don't know what scratch tracks are.
Please go ahead.
Scratch tracks are what are recorded before they hire the actual talent that's going to do the work after they've designed the animation or the storyboard or the commercial. They'll have somebody come in, usually the receptionist or, you know, a technician that has a decent voice, and just go, line one goes here, line two goes here, line three goes here. You know, they're not very good at it. He was, you know, decent at it, but thought there was more, and he decided he wanted to do audiobooks. And now he's actually getting hired to do some of the stuff that they do at their company.
So I guess he had, so her question was who were not voiceover artists. So I think Joseph does qualify as not having been a voiceover artist, even though he recorded some scratch tracks.
We have attorneys, we have stay-at-home moms, we have former, air traffic controllers who have retired.
he had been doing some voiceover.
I don't think in the audiobook space, but yeah.
Not in audiobooks. He'd been dabbling in voiceovers, auditioning on sites
Voice
like
123.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. I get people coming to me all the time going, you know, everyone tells me I have a terrific voice, and I think I should do voiceover. Well, my initial reaction is, yes, you do have a lovely voice, but that does not lead to the conclusion that you should do voiceover. It's certainly nice, and it's wonderful, but when you think about people like Wally Cox, who played the voice of Underdog, or Wilford Brimley, or, you know, pick your poison from the history that you're familiar with of people that don't have very nice voices. They just have interesting voices, and even more important, they love storytelling. When somebody comes to me and says, I want to be a voiceover artist because I love to tell stories, I want to grab them around the shoulder, take them to lunch, you know, give them a free half hour of my time talking about what they need to do. People that come to me and say, you know, or they say, I make these wacky character voices that my kids just love. You know, I just want to sit them down and go, okay, but do you want to sit alone for hours at a time reading material and bringing that material to life? If that's what you want to do, or in any other character, in any other category of voice work, what is required there, if that's what you want to do and you have a passion for it, it doesn't matter what business you're coming from. It doesn't matter whether you're an ex-attorney or you're a salesperson, a shop manager. What matters is, do you have this passion for telling a story? And when you have that, and we certainly help you find that in our class along with all the other stuff, when you have that, you are, as we've seen by the Mastermind group, pretty much unstoppable.
David, you possibly won't believe this. When you said, when people come up to me and say that everyone says I have such a good voice, I quickly wrote down some words. Here's what I wrote down, but before you continued, I wrote down, if you want to do audiobooks, instead of everyone tells me I have a lovely voice, ask yourself this question: do I enjoy telling stories?
Yep.
And that's really what it's all about.
And that's not dependent on whatever business you came out of. You could be a metal worker. And if you love sitting down at lunchtime, shooting the breeze with your fellow employees and telling them great stories, you know, then, you know, as Jeff says, you might be an audiobook narrator.
And just want to make sure we do give a very direct answer to Danielle's question. Yeah. I don't know the number of people, but it's more than one or two people who are in our mastermind group who have taken, you know, the ACX masterclass, more than just a couple who have no experience as actors or voiceover artists. I don't know the percentage, but it's frequent enough that we no longer get surprised.
Yeah, and I will also say that I encourage people to treat audiobook narration as part of a larger acting career. And it doesn't have to be I'm going after television, I'm going after films like I have. It might just be local community theater. It might be local dinner theater. It might be working with the students at the high school. But having an acting passion, that's what, to me, voiceover is. It's just another way of acting. I do an awful lot of on-camera acting. I do an awful lot of voice work. And I don't see the distinction between the two. So my suggestion is that since you can go and take acting classes anytime you want, consider it, because it will make you a better audiobook narrator. We have a mutual friend who is just a spectacular actor, and she is also a spectacular audiobook narrator, and both of them feed each other. Her ability to create accents and dialects and characters has led her to get work both on camera and on stage, and also get work doing audiobooks. And so when you get better at one area of acting, other areas of acting get better as well. So I would suggest that you consider taking acting classes, but are they required? No.
Great. I don't see a hand up. So I think we have reached the conclusion of this question and answer teleseminar for the ACX Masterclass with David H. Lawrence XVII and me, Dan O'Day. And congratulations again, Robert Taylor, Rancho Mirage, joined us during. I always like that. I love that when that happens when we're still doing the teleseminar. I don't know why. It's just kind of cool. So welcome, Robert. You have the web address, acxmasterclass.com. If you're going to join the class, please sign up today or absolutely not later than tomorrow, which is Sunday, because the bonuses that we are offering are direct coaching or consulting from David and from me. So it's private consulting with me usually, and with David it might be directing, it might be consulting. It all depends on what you need. So, you know, please sign up before those bonuses go away. David, now somebody raised his or her hand. Should we just leave because we said there are no more questions and
no.
You know, we don't care? Okay.
No, don't be a Nimrod.
Good afternoon, David and Dan. Robert Taylor here. Question I have for you actually probably does not relate so much to the technical side of the audio book industry, but it's more, my question is, do you have any information on what are the broad brush numbers for the number of titles that are going to audiobook across all genres, fiction, nonfiction? I mean, I understand it's a growing business, but do you have any information at all, even in a broad brush treatment of how big this is? How big is it anticipated to become, say, over a 5 or a 10 year period?
So the current projections by the Audiobook Publishers Association show a hockey stick. Do you know what that means?
Sure do.
When you look at a graph, a hockey stick. Think of a hockey stick laying on its back, or being held up by its blade, and either way, the angle shoots up greater than 45 degrees. And that's been happening for the past 5 years, due in no small measure to Audible being owned by Amazon, and Amazon pushing this business, and iTunes being a huge force in the spoken word market and the music market. And the projections are that as more and more authors go outside the traditional publishing channels and use channels like Kindle, where moving from a Kindle book to an ACX audiobook is a click of a button. You literally go into ACX as an author, find your book in the Kindle marketplace, claim it, and click the button and say, I want to make this an ACX project. That's how easy it is. Imagine how difficult it has been throughout the years for an author or a rights holder, a publisher, to get an audiobook even started. So with this frictionless new world of, you know, here's the thing, here's some numbers. Currently available on the ACX site, over 4,000 books that have yet to be cast. So if that isn't a big enough, I mean, that's the number of parts that get cast, a little bit more than the number of parts that get cast every year here in Hollywood for work on television. So it's certainly more plentiful than any other category of acting, and it's more plentiful than most categories of voice work. I think the only other category that might be more plentiful would be IVR and phone prompts. But audiobooks, exploding. This is not a diminishing return. This is an asset that is gaining in value.
And Robert, David mentioned something that because you signed up for the class, I'm gonna start your education now. Okay, nobody else will listen to this because some of you guys haven't signed up yet. So if you haven't signed up, you don't listen to this part. David mentioned Kindle authors. So Kindle has, and Amazon in general, not just for Kindle books, but for any kind of book, but especially Kindle books, has made it possible for so many more would-be authors to become published authors than ever before. And here, Robert, here is your first lesson that your competitors do not think about. Imagine that you are a writer, you've published one or more books, and now you're going to have, for the first time, one of your books made into an audiobook. So you've gone to ACX because an author friend told you about it, and now you're going to try to find a narrator. How do you think that author feels? Nervous. They're terrified. And they will hire the narrator who not only has the chops, but the narrator who makes them feel safe. The narrator who the author can say, okay, you know what? If I hire this person, that's going to be good. And that happens a whole lot. And you know, this is, you know, David, I'm sure, can tell you many, many real stories about this. But actors who audition, a lot of times in Hollywood, the audition doesn't go to the absolute best actor. You know, they reach a point where they say, you know what? That guy, he can do it. Okay, the rest of you can go home. And maybe somebody out there could have done better. But they knew if they hired that guy, they believed, at least, if they hired that guy, he would not let them down. This guy can handle it. And yep, That's a big, big part of getting work anywhere, any kind of voiceover work, but especially on ACX. So how you present yourself, what your profile looks like, what your photo looks like, just all of that, how you interact with rights holders. And I'll give a little plug for the class. One of the really cool things that David thought of adding, you know, David has written email templates for pretty much any imaginable encounter with a rights holder. And David, I assume that when you would have a new type of encounter, that's when you would write the email and you saved it and made it a template.
Yep.
And so instead of, that's part of the course now. We give you the templates. So, and if you're listening and you're not going to take the ACX Masterclass, but you're on ACX, you should not be waiting to receive a particular type of communique from a rights holder before you know how you will respond to it. So when a rights holder expresses interest but has a question, you should not have to think about it. You should pull out the template that you created for yourself and send it off. And it's like, if you do it the way most of your competitors on ACX do it, that is like waiting until the beep on the person's answering machine or voicemail to give any thought at all to what your message is going to be. You know, and if I actually teach a class in getting voicemail messages returned. And so what I start off by saying is, if you know that there is a chance you're going to get voicemail, you know you're going to have to decide what to say. Wouldn't it be a good idea to decide before it happens and you're on the spot and you stammer and sound like an idiot? Same way here. Know what you're going to say. Know that part of your job is reassuring authors. And David calls it hand-holding, and he teaches that in the course. You reassure authors not only in the ways we've described, but in the way you present yourself and the way you interact with them throughout the entire process. And for a whole lot of them, once they realize, oh, this person understands how it all works, and I like the way he sounds, I'll listen to the audition, I'm going to go with that person.
So yeah, and even more likely, and I know this is kind of, especially for us as artists, this is kind of depressing, but just to the point of Dan saying, you know, working with the right person rather than the best person, oftentimes, because producers think like business people, because rights holders think like business people sometimes, although they do have certainly an artistic bent, they are often very, very likely to hire someone that they have confidence will get the project done, even if they are not the best artist. Many of us have had interactions with artists that are just too expensive. And I don't mean expensive in terms of their compensation. I mean expensive in terms of how much of our life they suck away from us because they are so needy or so entitled or so arrogant or so imperious, and they're not team players. And, you know, you could have the best author, narrator, or best audiobook narrator in the world. If they're difficult to work with, if they don't understand how the system works, it's not worth it. Certainly not worth it to a rights holder. So that's one of the things that you want to bear in mind, is that being a great business person at this and being prepared for those moments is almost more important than being excellent at your work. I think both are very important, but I think if you ignore the business side of things, you're not going to have nearly as much work as you could.
Well, and there is an additional element of what David just said. I mean, the bottom line is people like to work with people they like to work with. That applies in television, movies, music, voiceover, everywhere. People like to work with people they like to work with. So if you are the first narrator that a new rights holder works with, and they have a wonderful experience with you, guess who has the single best shot at getting their next book and their next book and their next book? And we refer to that as becoming the narrator of choice, which I think is, we got that from one of your very first students, Steve Marvel. So, David, somebody else has raised their hand. Now,
oh, come on. No.
Yeah.
All right.
And I hope she heard us answer the question that she sent us in advance. Let's find out.
Hi, it's Gwen. Hi, Dan. Hey. Hi, David.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm sorry, I am working, so I'm in and out, so I'm going to just ask this and then get off. I was looking into the idea of auditioning for some of the ones that I guess would be labeled erotica or deep romance, I don't know what you want to call it, and I had not auditioned for any of those before because I really didn't think I had the technique to do that, but in listening to the excerpts, I'm not hearing a lot of difference in the voices that are voicing those books. Could you address, is there anything about those books other than the fact that you have to negotiate certain words or, you know, how you do that? Is there a technique involved in that?
Well, and since David has far more experience than I in consuming erotica, I'll leave
consuming?
That. Yeah.
Consuming? Okay. Go ahead.
No. So is there your?
There's two questions in here that I heard. Number one is there any difference in auditioning for erotica and auditioning for other categories? And the answer there for me is no, because the story drives your audition. So, you know, the reverse answer is, of course. There's a difference between nonfiction and fiction and historical romance and erotica. The difference is the content, the material that's presented. That will inform your audition, not the category of work. Because the fact of the matter is that, you know, erotica itself is a category of serial titillating scenes, right? I mean, if you wanted to call it pornography, you could. A lot of it is not as hardcore as that. But the truth of the matter is that mainstream, best-selling, New York Times top bestsellers include very explicit and very erotic scenes 90% of the time. Think back to the book The Godfather. Not that I know this by heart, but on page 22 and 23 is a very graphic description of Sonny taking one of the bridesmaids, Lucy, in a closet. I recall from my youth reading this, wow, this has to be illegal. This can't be actually in a book that they sell on the counter, over the counter. This, you got to get a note from your parents to get this, but you know. So the point is that it's not the category of work that that gives you the impetus for the audition or for the work. It's the work itself. It's the stuff itself. Now, there was something that you said, and are you still unmuted?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay,
I don't know,
you said something about, you know, I know that there's this negotiation of certain words and things like that. Do you mean negotiating as if you were negotiating a river, or are you talking about negotiating whether you'd say them with the rights holder?
Technically, how you say those words so it doesn't.
Got it. So it's not like you're saying to the rights holder, I'm not willing to say those words.
No.
Let's come up with something else.
No, it's just how
good.
You as an actor say those words.
Good. Got it.
I guess I feel like I sound silly saying those words. And then I go back and listen to it.
So I can disabuse you of that very quickly by just saying decide not to feel like you're silly, because it's the same thing as if somebody is this Gwen Trussler?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So you've done stage work before. You've done screen work before. I don't know if you've ever done nudity before, but you know, people feel a little silly when they first start to do nudity on screen, and they're embarrassed and they're certainly concerned about who's on set and all those things. And then eventually you get the work done and you don't worry about it anymore. So it's the same thing with erotica. When you are negotiating the path to erotica, you're putting yourself in the position of the speaker no matter what you're doing, whether it's erotica or fiction or nonfiction or historical romance or how-to books, children's books. It doesn't matter. It's the content, not the category.
And with some being stronger than others, ultimately you are telling a story. You know, it might not be the kind of storytelling you grew up hearing, but...
Speak for yourself, Dan.
From the author's point of view. Well, David, I'm still trying to get past you doing nudity in movies, okay?
Yeah.
So now there are no more questions.
All right.
This brings us to the end of the Q&A teleseminar. I'm Dan O'Day. That gentleman there is David H. Lawrence, the 17th. And in case you joined us late, we are teaching the home study course of the ACX Masterclass, and this is for people who already narrate audiobooks or who want to narrate audiobooks. You will find all the information on our website, which is acxmasterclass.com. All the information is there for you. If you're not sure, you know, you're trying to make up your mind, you might there's on that website, there's a tab at the top that says what our graduates say, and you'll see their name and photo and their exact words, and you know, maybe they can help you decide. And I think I am out of last words. Do you have any last words, David?
Oh, sure. Remuneration.
No, David, I'm sorry. You're not getting paid for this call. We didn't discuss
what?
That? You're not getting paid for this call, David.
Well, I'm not going to choose a different last word.
Okay. So thank you, everybody. Great questions. We really appreciate your spending part of your weekend with us. For those of you who are going to join us on this journey, it's really cool. And I was about to speak for both of us. I'll speak for me and see if David agrees. David, to this day, I find it very exciting every time a student in the Mastermind group posts the new project they got. Do you have you gotten accustomed to it and it doesn't matter, or do you?
No, it's great. It's the one thing that makes me want to, you know, whoop it up and say good job and like their post and all that. It's just so much fun to know that by taking the class, they're getting results.
So I think we've reached the end. Thank you, everybody. David H. Lawrence, the 17th. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan O'Day.
And we will. We'll see all of you inside the ACX Masterclass Summer Course. Because, by golly, I know every single person hearing this is going to join us. David, order extra donuts and coffee, okay?
I will do that.
Okay. Thanks, everybody.